everybody. Welcome to our weekly Green Socialist podcast. It's just me this week. Angela was kept late at work. That's one of the things that happens when you got a time clock to punch and the boss says, we need you. So I'm going to have to handle this all by myself. I just have a few comments about what's going on. Biden said to people that want to migrate here, and most of them are coming from Central America for asylum. It's not so much a job pull that, you know, we've had for a long time from Mexico. He said, don't come. And his administration and mainstream media is treating migration as a problem when it should be seen as a blessing for this country. I mean, almost all of us in this country's ancestors came from somewhere else. And just as a practical matter, and it's, you know, enriched our country. And just as a practical matter, you know, we've been pushing for a radical eco-socialist Green New Deal that will get us to 100% clean energy and zero emissions in a decade. And the bottleneck is labor. This country has a huge carbon footprint, and if we're going to transform it, we don't even have enough people to do the work. And you can see that on our eco-socialist budget on the website, howiehawkins.us. It creates 38 million jobs. That's more than the number of people we have unemployed now, and not everybody who's unemployed is suitable for the construction and manufacturing that a lot of these jobs are going to be. So, and of course, we call for open borders. It's a basic human right, freedom of movement, mobility, and that border basically divides working people. And they use the low wages on the other side of the border to undermine wages on this side. So there are a lot of reasons to get rid of it. And just as a moral humanitarian reason, people seeking asylum in this country, Statue of Liberty, you know, that's what we are in our best tradition. And unfortunately, the Biden administration is treating this like it's a problem rather than an opportunity to do the right thing. And speaking of the, you know, climate plan, Biden tomorrow is going to be in Pittsburgh, and he's going to unveil, or at least outline, what he's calling an infrastructure bill. And in that is his climate plan. And we know enough about what it is that we know it's totally inadequate. It's too late for gradualism. The budget for the world to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperatures, which is seen as a threshold beyond which we might get runaway global warming in a total catastrophe. When they made that announcement, when they issued the International Panel on Climate Change, issued that 1.5 degree report, they said we had 400 gigatons of carbon left in the world's carbon budget. That was as of January 2018. We're down to under 300 gigatons. At the rate we're going in 2027, we're going to blow through that budget. And there's been no progress in any of these countries. So what Biden's going to propose, I'm going to write up a comment on it, but I can tell you right now, the theme is going to be, it's too late for gradualism. And where he's talking about maybe a trillion at best investments in clean energy, the budget we came up with was 2.7 trillion per year over a decade. And we priced it out. That's what it's going to take. So it's too late for gradualism, and we've got to raise that issue. So there's a lot going on. The George Floyd trial is live. It's heart-wrenching. I caught a little bit on radio. But let's get into tonight's topic. It's Women's Month, and we wanted to talk about reproductive justice, and we're talking about reproductive justice for whom? And we have three Latin American women to talk about its impact on their communities. And, you know, their impact is not just access to, say, abortion. It's the freedom to reproduce. We had a terrible problem of forced sterilizations in Puerto Rico from the 1930s to the 1970s. Something like a third of Puerto Rican women were sterilized. And Recently, we had hysterectomies of women, without consent down there in Georgia, for women that were held in detention as immigrants. So there's a lot of angles to this issue. And so we have three speakers tonight, and they are Olwi Robles, Annie Martinez, and Karina Acri-Paez. And we're going to start with Olwi Robles Toro, who's a longtime community activist from the Bronx with a particular focus in the Puerto Rican community. She's a former substance abuse counselor. She was a member of the Young Lords, which was a sort of Puerto Rican version of the Black Panther Party. And Ramon Jimenez was my running mate for Attorney General. I know he worked with the Young Lords for decades before he passed on. And so it's good to have you on. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. You want me to say something?
Yeah, it's you. You've got the floor.
Okay, thank you. My name is Olwi Robles Toro. I am 68 years old. I've been around through the 50s to the present, watching all sorts of injustice done by the American government and the elites in America. What has happened throughout the years is not really different than what's happening now, except that I feel it's graver. The problem is graver because the threat of fascism in America is real and quite threatening. The eugenics program that was established in the 20s, which is the idea that you could weed out the unfit, quote unquote, the people who have been thought of as feeble-minded criminals, people who are prisoners, people who are of races that are considered beneath an IQ, a stature, stamina, class. That idea was prevalent then, and I see it as prevalent now. What has gone down, not only in Puerto Rico, but in the United States and all over the world, through the sterilization of women, particularly women of color, it's not only horrendous, it was a form of genocide to depopulate, they say Puerto Rico because it was overpopulated and it was too impoverished and people had no real chance of working, but they don't tell you that Puerto Rico had been a colony of Spain, was then transferred into the hands of the United States government by the late 1800s, 1898 to be precise, U.S. government took over Puerto Rico. Very shortly after taking over, there was a conversation that it was overly populated and that something had to be done. There was talk about how there were too many people who were not employed. They were not capable of earning and achieving and progressing. And therefore, the idea, the eugenics idea of depopulation and sterilization became a model for Puerto Rico. So we had a law passed in Puerto Rico. Law 116 was based on the eugenics idea of depopulating and making sure that, you know, only the fittest survive. And through that law, and the fact that the United States government had industries take over the land of the farmers in Puerto Rico, displacing them, making them more impoverished, the idea of the only solution would be to depopulate the island. So there was two options: sterilize the people because men were also sterilized, not just women, although it was women in the main, and to ship over cheap labor from Puerto Rico into the United States through Operation Bootstrap. This led to more than 37% of the people in Puerto Rico of childbearing age being sterilized by 1976. I don't believe that it has stopped. I believe that it's more incognito. They called a certain period of time in Puerto Rico that there was informed consent, but there wasn't. Women were being forced to, as they did to the Chicanas and to the Native Americans and African Americans in America, they were forced to sign papers while in the process of their giving birth, in the time of distress, of pain and agony. They were told that they could not get services unless they signed papers to have the operation. We call it la operación. So women were harassed, finagled, bamboozled into signing forms for sterilization. Many of them through door-to-door outreach by different organizations, because Procter & Gamble was involved in the sterilization and contraceptive trials in Puerto Rico. So was John Rockefeller. So was Margaret Sanger, who was supposed to have been the pioneer for Planned Parenthood. They were involved in the atrocities in Puerto Rico, facilitating the abuse of the women in Puerto Rico. So moving forward to today, not seeing much political change in terms of our government and the idea of, particularly pushed by Trump, of making America great again, understanding that there's sterilization being done on women today, and that as far back as 2014, they were sterilizing people with HIV. I just wanted to just add, this is an international problem. This is not just a Latina problem. It is not just a Black problem. It is a problem for poor people, because the eugenics program addressed sterilizing the immigrants of that time. And the immigrants of that time were Scandinavian, they were Italian, they were Russian, so they were poor whites. People who had mental illness, people who had physical disabilities, were not only sterilized, but used as experiments, or in experiments rather. So the concept that was applied then and was applied from the 30s to the 70s in Puerto Rico, in the United States, which was heightened with the Chicano movement in the 50s to the 70s, as documented, because I still believe that it's going down, just not spoken of and not as clear cut, because people don't really follow the patterns and continue to study what is in fact going on. A lot of people during the period of time that I'm talking about were told that if they didn't submit to sterilization, they will not be able to have benefits. Whether it's, you know, welfare benefits, coupon benefits, or hospital care benefits. We see today that people are being denied access. So we were talking about, right, what is reproductive justice and for whom? And what is the difference between reproductive justice and reproductive rights? Well, the women's movement fought in America for reproductive rights, the rights to be able to choose whether you have a baby, don't have a baby, the rights to be able to use contraceptives, because in the about 1937, there was a law pushed. It was in 1937. I'm trying to remember when the Comstock law was instituted. 1873. They didn't want you to talk about contraceptives. They didn't want you to talk about anything or even write or publish anything that had to do with utilizing prevention for pregnancies. Women at that time couldn't even have a bank account. They couldn't go to college. They couldn't do anything without a male's approval. So we got industrialization, we had the war, and the women took over working in factories, and then there was a move for more independence and the ability, which is one of the things they used in Puerto Rico to psych the women out. If, you know, you have to work, if you want to work in the factories, then you have to submit to sterilization because you can't have more than two children. If you have more than two children, then it's a must. They even put clinics inside of the factories to make sure that they covered their base so that the women would have immediate attention while in the factories. And I see that as I have seen in the 70s, even in New York. I mean, I was in New York, I was a young girl. I was in the Young Lords. I don't think I was in the Young Lords more than a year. And I was asked to undergo hysterectomy because I had had problems with dysmenorrhea, which meant heavy bleeding and severe cramping. And the doctor suggested that I have it done. Now, I was 17 years old. I had a little bit of gumption because I was involved in the Young Lords. So I kind of evolved out of being a shy young woman to being a more assertive person, to being a little bit clearer as to who I am and what I wanted to do in my life. And I had to ask this doctor who was 36 years old, how would you feel if I castrate you? He jumped back, unconsciously cuffed his crotch, and looked at me as if like, what are you talking about? And I says, see your reaction. You're asking me, a 17-year-old who never bore, had been pregnant or had a child, to have a hysterectomy. But you react when I ask you to, how would you feel if I talked to you and said you should be castrated? Most people don't stop to think what's the reality. What people are really living, just like they don't understand that the people living in Puerto Rico during that period of time were not only being displaced from their homes and were losing their means of livelihood, but they were also being told that their offsprings would not be born because they had one too many kids. And they were the problem. The poor in this country have been the problem, and not that capitalism in its nature is a problem, that profits before people is a problem. The fact that people cannot get what the women fought for is a problem, which is why reproductive justice is different than reproductive rights. People of color, people who have no insurance, people who are impoverished can't get reproductive rights. They cannot get access to reproductive rights. In Puerto Rico, the pill was too expensive, and they were tested on in Puerto Rico. About 1,500 women were used as guinea pigs to produce the pill that was brought to the United States and sold in the United States and in Puerto Rico because of the laws, because you can't, when you export stuff and they sell it back to Puerto Rico, they sell it at a higher cost. They don't tell you that either, that the laws in Puerto Rico in terms of trade, you can only trade with the United States and only the United States and no one else. And when you grow, let's say, sugar canes and develop sugar, you have to buy it back from the United States at a higher cost. The same thing happened with the pills. The cost in America was not the cost in Puerto Rico. And I think that that's important to see the economic part of it and the fact that reproductive justice has to do with the economic, political, and social issues that poor people face, particularly people of color. And I see, I don't know if you want to ask questions. I don't know if I'm going on a tantrum.
No, you've been preaching the truth. But let's get our other speakers in, and then we'll do question and answers. So okay. Let's bring on Annie Martinez, who's a Denver-based attorney who specializes in family and criminal defense, as well as domestic relations. Annie's practice is dedicated to advocating for the most disenfranchised communities. She's the immediate past president of the Colorado Hispanic Bar Association, a former Green Party candidate for Denver City Council, and an active community leader. Welcome, Annie.
Hola, Howie. Happy to be here. I think I'll piggyback off a little bit of Olgi's conversation and kind of start off with reproductive justice. And so organizations such as Sister Song, which have existed for a long time to uplift the collective voices of Indigenous women and women of color, have really broadened the definition of just reproductive rights to reproductive justice, which is a bigger umbrella that covers a lot more. And part of what reproductive justice really covers is the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, to be able to have children, to not have children, and to, most importantly, I think that gets left out of the conversation, is to parent the children that one has in a safe and sustainable way and in safe and sustainable communities. And that's something that definitely has been historically an issue in the United States. Indigenous women, women of color, have always had to face the biggest barriers, not only in terms of having access to reproductive health care, but then on top of that, being able to raise their children. Black and brown women, particularly, and Indigenous women as well, are the families that are most targeted by child welfare and are the communities that see the highest level of removals. And so what we've seen is this genocide, not just in the physical sense of these forced hysterectomies that have happened historically in this nation's history, but then with the actions that the court system has backed up. If they didn't get you at the beginning, they're going to get you at some point when your kid is maybe 6 years old and you're struggling, whether it be with mental health, with addiction, or with just keeping a roof over your head. But at some point, the system is coming in to tear your family apart, whether it starts from being able to have that family to begin with, or whether they get you later on in terms of when your family is facing the most problems and could use the most support. So that kind of ties in a lot to the type of work that I practice. I do some immigration work, and I have seen just the deplorable conditions that exist in the detainment centers. But we also know that we've got these same detainment centers holding children. So we're displacing children and ruining families there. But then also I work as a Respondent Parent Council in Colorado, which is sort of like a public defender, but for parents who and get involved with the child welfare system. And so what I see there is just the continuation of how America ruins families of color and how the mothers are the ones that face the biggest impact of that, aside from the children. I mean, these are moms that just had a baby and have that baby torn away from them at the womb, you know, at the teat, essentially in the hospital because they were born exposed. And that is not a trauma-informed way to deal with mental health and with a child that perhaps was born exposed to substances. So this topic of reproductive justice for whom is really one that touches upon history and also touches upon future in terms of like, what do we continue to do to women of color and disenfranchised women across the country with their ability to have children, not have children, and parent them safely and in their homes and not have government involvement. And so this is a topic that's definitely near and dear to my heart, and I can be on my soapbox for a while. I don't want to ramble too long, but definitely I'll save some time for questions on these topics because there's so much to talk about with respects to them. But I just want to kind of summarize that's where I'm coming from. My perspective is here to discuss about reproductive justice as an umbrella, add some context based on what questions we get. But reproductive justice affects not only the physical, but also in terms of what we've done to women's bodies, but how we've torn families apart.
Okay, thank you, Annie. Let's get our last speaker in, and then we'll get to questions and answers. So our next speaker is Karina Acri-Pais, who has worked professionally in the field of immigration law for 20 years. She's a founding member of Tele Jaguar Chicano Media Collective and has worked in numerous social justice campaigns for migrants and asylum seekers, with murdered and missing Indigenous women, Standing Rock, and in an organizational leadership capacity toward a broad front coalition for a revolutionary political party. Welcome, Karina.
Thank you, Hallie. I'm so honored to be here. Thank you for this platform. I enjoyed listening to my colleagues thus far for the very interesting comments, so thank you for that. I was specifically prepared to speak on the most recent story, the most recent manifestation that we've seen of forced hysterectomies in the United States with regard to women who are being held in ICE detention centers. So on September 14th, 2020, a news story broke about an Erwin County, Georgia detention center that had been accused of medical neglect due to COVID, as well as numerous hysterectomies without consent. So the whistleblower in this case was actually a nurse. She was a nurse who was employed working a stint in the Georgia ICE Detention Center. And she broke the story about these forced hysterectomies and abuses that were happening at the detention center in Erwin County. So with this particular detention center, at least 57 women say they were forced or pressured into having unwanted gynecological procedures. More than 40 of these women submitted testimony claiming abuse about the practices and the unnecessary invasive procedures that they went through. So nurse Dawn Wooten was the whistleblower's name. In her complaint, she reported an alarmingly high rate of hysterectomies, which, as we know, is a surgery to remove part or all of the uterus. And this was being performed specifically on Spanish-speaking immigrants. So we're looking at a select group of ICE detention incarcerated people who are being subjected to this. So most of these Spanish-speaking immigrant or women asylum seekers did not appear to understand what they had gone through until after the fact. So Nurse Wooten explained that an off-site doctor performed all of these unwanted surgeries on women. In some of the cases, the women had complained of heavy menstrual cycles. In some cases, they were referred to the doctor without any request, and they were unsure why they had been referred to the doctor. And with regard to the issue of consent, some nurses who were involved with the doctor that I'm going to tell you about said that in some cases, they claim to have obtained consent by using Google Translator with the women. So Nurse Wooten said about the doctor that was doing these surgeries, she said, quote, everyone he sees has a hysterectomy, just about everybody. That's his specialty. He's the uterus collector. Everybody's uterus can't be that bad. So not only did these women have unwanted hysterectomies, but they were sent to a highly corrupt doctor who is well known for questionable medical practices. This doctor's name is Dr. Mahendra Amin. And there are a few testimonies that I can share from women about what they experienced while they were sent to go see him. He told several of these women that they had stage 4 cervical cancer and needed to remove their uterus. Later, all of these women were told by oncologists that they never even had cancer. Dr. Mahendra Amin also often removed the wrong ovary. So that means that he would go back in and remove the other ovary, thereby being able to charge for a second unnecessary surgery. In 2015, he paid a fine of over $500,000 for fraudulent claims through Medicaid, and numerous complaints have been made about Dr. Amin for years by attorneys representing detainees. So this is something that has been going on for years, and thankfully, a courageous nurse finally broke the story. This doctor is currently the medical director at Irwin County Hospital, and he has his own private practice. One woman said that she woke up from surgery chained to a hospital bed. And Dr. Amin had told her that he had to give her surgery to scrape tissue from her uterus. But this was without her consent, she claimed. Before she was sedated, Dr. Amin told her that he had to drain an ovarian cyst. And he also told her that if she refused care, she would no longer have access to any medical treatment. Now, this obviously mimics exactly the same thing that Ogley explained. This is the same thing that was told to Puerto Rican women. If they did not consent, they would be refused any type of additional medical care. This was the same kind of threat that was given to Mexican women in the documented case that was happening at Los Angeles County USC Medical Center in the late 60s and 70s. So the very same thing. Now, if we consider that the United Nations defines, quote, imposing measures intended to prevent births within a group as an act of genocide, a crime against international law. So what we're looking at here are gross human rights violations, and the US government should be held accountable. Now, we can also consider that the Irwin Detention Center, a story, was not unique. The same human rights organization that filed a complaint after Dr. Nurse Wooten broke this story, they have filed other abuse allegations about the very same center. Now, this center that is run in Irwin County, now to give kind of a big picture of how you can envision this multiplying, right? The center that ran that Irwin County Detention Center, the company that ran that one, also ran 17 other detention centers. So there's no reason to think that this was uncommon to Georgia, because they had a lucky whistleblower and that was courageous enough to break the story. So this particular center has had multiple reports since 2017 about it being unfit in one report, it was cited as being, quote, unfit for humans. And also people being withheld food if they didn't want to get this quote unquote medical care. So we can look at what has happened since then to these women as a further testament to the intent behind this kind of practice. More than half of the women who submitted testimony have now been deported. So you can see clearly the objective there is to remove witnesses. Now that they have been outed. So big picture here, what we're looking at is obviously, a lot of people don't understand why suddenly all these people are showing up to the border. So it's not something that just happened. It's not something that's new. This has been happening for years. This is the product of decades of U.S. intervention in Central America and South American countries. This is the product of corrupt policies by U.S. empire that have economic and political policies that have devastated countries, that have forcibly removed democratically elected governments in these countries, in Central American countries, and then replace them with puppet dictators who will favor U.S. empire policies. One example of this is Honduras, when in 2009, under the watch of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton backed a coup, which resulted in the assassination of Berta Cáceres, a famous, well-known advocate for indigenous, advocate for ecological issues in her country. Honduras became then one of the most dangerous places on planet Earth as a result of that U.S.-backed coup. So we've had numerous administrations that have had time to prepare for this. This is not an overnight thing. When this started happening about 10 years ago, when we saw a great influx of unaccompanied minors and women and children asylum seekers, what did the Obama administration do? Well, they could have chosen a humane approach, but instead they chose to unleash a mass incarceration for profit system. And one of the examples of this, which is not spoken about very often, is just before leaving office, Barack Obama signed a $1 billion contract with Correction Corporation of America to build a prison to house women and children asylum seekers. So you can see not only have these people been traumatized and forced to flee from their countries as a result of U.S. policy, but once they get here and seek asylum, which the U.S. government is bound to do, not only by U.S. federal code, but by international treaty law, the U.S. is bound to allow people to apply for asylum and accept asylum seekers. But they are re-traumatized after they get here by these gross human rights violations that are occurring once they are in ICE detention.
Well, thank you, Karina. If there was a common theme, I think it's that people are saying we need to move beyond a fairly narrow concept of reproductive rights to a broader concept of reproductive justice. And people who are listening can write their questions in the chat and we will get them to the speakers. But to get us started, where's the leverage for us in the fight for reproductive justice? Are there organizations and movements right now that are on the cutting edge and people listening could get involved in or support? Are there any allies in the federal government, anybody in Congress? I don't think we have it in the Biden administration, but is there anybody? So what do y'all think about that? And looks like Ogi wants to speak, so go right ahead.
I am just looking at the growing movement of Black Lives Matters, the growing movement of the Native American women, and even the movement of people in the struggle with HIV who are exposing what has been going on with people with HIV also being sterilized. I think that we do need a organization that represents the multinational working class of America. And that organization needs to be consolidated, and have its platform and program where it's very clearly standing on integrity and principles of humanity, because what we've been offered is not working. We have a Democratic Party and a Republican Party, neither of which are really representing the working class people of America. We have organizations that are independent and they're working on different issues, but we're not coming together. And we really cannot stop not only the sterilization, the abuse of different third world people in America or outside of America, we cannot deal with the oncoming issues of establishing fascism in America and even worldwide, unless we all come together. We talked about climate change in the beginning and how we're dealing with bad policies towards that. We have problems with our food products. They're too contaminated. The ground is contaminated with Roundup, and we have too many foods with additives and preservatives and too many fast foods in poor neighborhoods that are killing us. We have poor medical coverage. There's so many things that we need to address that it means that we have to come together. We can't do it in isolation. Now, we talked about sterilization and women's issues, and I'm sure that, you know, like the sister had talked about the Native American Sister Song group. If we can all try to find a way to bring it together so that we can deal with the issues that we're confronting. I am a grandmother of 7 children. I am an aunt of more than 15 nephews and nieces that are babies. My grandchildren range from the ages of 5 to 15. I'm concerned for their future. I'm worried about what will happen to my granddaughters in the next couple of years, because I'm also concerned about the sex trafficking of children and children that are missing in poor communities, and nobody's talked about it and no one's doing anything about it. I live in Jamaica, Queens, and I don't know what happened to 4 children that went missing. No one's followed up. Well, they're brown kids and no one's followed up. So these are the things that sit in my mind. And how can we bring ourselves together as people of color and people who are conscientious? Because I don't think that it's all a black and white issue. I don't think that it's all about, you know, you exclude one nation for another. I think it's about developing awareness to the point where no matter what your color is, what nationality, creed, or religion you are, you get together on principles of humanity. But those are my thoughts. And I've been trying to teach my grandchildren, because I'm also limited right now. I'm a caregiver, so I'm limited in caregiving my mother and my grandchildren and making sure that they're taken care of. So I'm limited in how much activity I can do, because caregiving is a full-time job. But
Annie, do you have any thoughts on that question?
Yeah, a few. So most states have reproductive justice groups that are pretty active. Like Colorado has CALOR, which is the Colorado, it's for Latinas for reproductive justice in Colorado. Most states have a group that have been around for quite some time and are working on these issues as an umbrella. In terms of upcoming legislation, what's unfortunate is that as a country, we're still in certain states and jurisdictions fighting back abortion access laws. You know, so how are these states and these groups able to really push ahead when they're still trying to fight for access to just that? How is their reproductive justice groups able to handle all these other issues that we're identifying when they're still at ground zero? So I think supporting our hermanos and hermanas in the fight towards access in those states is important too, so that they can continue pushing the fight forward that other states are able to do. And then with respects to upcoming legislation, there is a new campaign that's starting. Actually, some of the most recent news is of this month, where activists are preparing on a national campaign to repeal the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which is the ASFA that had passed in the late 90s. That's one of the acts. But most importantly, what that act defined was that if children are in foster care for 15 of the last 22 months, the state is obligated to push towards terminating the parents' rights and getting them adopted. And that was obviously a pendulum swing with the whole fake crack epidemic and everything else that was going on at that time period, where children were being unnecessarily removed in high numbers, and then parents were not being provided the support to get safe and sober, to have their children come back. And so waves of children at that time were all put up for adoption after this act passed, and it's been going on. What we're lucky to have now is that the social sciences and social workers out there have really been pushing for the system to be more trauma-informed and focused, and recognizing that the harm of removal is greater than half the stuff we do. Than half the stuff the children are encountering at home, the removal and going into foster care is much more traumatizing. And so there's now the new push of repealing the ASFA so that parents don't have this arbitrary 1 year mark of having to magically get perfect so they can get their kids back. So that's definitely an issue that is growing in momentum to try to get that repealed, which I would be in support of, obviously. But I think those are some of the biggest things. And I do agree that reproductive justice is a bigger umbrella term that has really hurt families of color, particularly Latin, Black, and Indigenous families. We have something called the Indian Child Welfare Act that came into effect because 3 out of 10 Native American children were being removed and put in the foster care system. So there's things out there that recognize some of the harm the system has created and is trying to rectify it. But to a lot of your point earlier, Howie, it's too slow, too incremental, too piecemeal. People are in desperation now. Families are being ruined yesterday. We don't have time for incremental change. And so we really need to try to, luchamos juntos, right? Get our voices together and pull our ability to not only work with the different groups that already exist, but then really try to strengthen our local Green Party chapters, whether they be on a smaller level or statewide. So that way we have that progressive voice on these issues. We have us unified out there, making sure that these things are being addressed in the right way, because so many more people agree once they hear this information, but they're not hearing it. They don't know. This is not stuff that the average person gets access to for one reason or another. And hopefully by sharing it and putting it out there, individuals realize, well, you know what? The Green Party is the home for me. That is where I can fight on these things that matter most to me. And we can really start pushing for significant change rather than chump change.
And Karina, why don't you give your response to that question?
Thank you, Howie. So in addressing this and the scope of the problem with asylum cases, I think I can let me share some statistics with you to kind of give you a backdrop so you can see how backlogged the cases are. And first of all, I'd like to say, we hear a lot of people Ms. Martinez said, a lot of people that aren't aware of U.S. immigration law, and so they make this assumption that there's something wrong, that there's something that the people did wrong, which is why they ended up in detention. They didn't do anything wrong. One is allowed to apply for asylum from within the United States or at a Class A port of entry. So you present yourself for inspection at a Class A port of entry. That's exactly what these people are doing. Once again, it's not only United States federal code, but international treaty law that we are bound to accept asylees and asylum applicants. Now, in terms of the growth dysfunction at immigration, I can share with you a couple of statistics which kind of paint a picture as to how backlogged this system is once people are actually able to submit asylum applications. Now, some asylum applications are handled at USCIS service centers, and some are handled in another office. So as of December 2020, the number of asylum cases pending at USCIS, which is United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, as of December 2020, there were 350,000 asylum cases pending. Now, some cases that are at USCIS office get referred to what is called the Executive Office for Immigration Review. That is a separate office that handles asylum applications. At that office, as of December 2020, there were over 570,000 pending asylum applications. So when you combine those two together, you're looking at well over 900,000 asylum applications that are pending. How long do these applications take to be adjudicated? Anywhere from 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, all depends on the material facts of your case and how strong your evidence is. And, you know, that's why these people end up languishing in detention centers for years and years and years. The backdrop of that is obviously the United States is making money from their incarceration. So in terms of any sweeping changes, we have to have some kind of option outside the duopoly, because we're not going to get any different policies coming out from either the Republican or the Democratic Party.
All right. I'm not going to argue with that. Eric Gray has a question. As men, what can we do to help fight for reproductive justice, since this is a crisis that threatens the future of humanity itself? And I'll let Olga go last this time and start with Annie. And we'll go the other around the circle that way.
So I think men, one of the strongest things that men can do is put their privilege on the line, whether it be at demonstrations, whether it be even at Planned Parenthood centers when women are trying to access a clinic. Sometimes you need people to help them walk into the clinic because of the violent protesters that are outside. But a big part of it is being part of the discussion, recognizing that as men, you carry privilege, and that for some people out there, they're going to listen to you more than they'll listen to the three of us, as educated and experienced as we are, by virtue of being, you know, women. We don't always get taken as seriously. And so, unfortunately, that is one of the realities that we live in. And when men are able to use that privilege and turn it from, you know, just being an ally to being proactive and really being out there on these issues and supporting them on these different levels, like I said, whether it be with your words or with your body at demonstrations or with supporting individuals in your community, that's really the biggest thing. So just being being vocal and being part of the stuff that your presence adds weight to it would be a big support.
Karina?
Thanks. Well, I would echo all of Ms. Martinez's comments and say that the person who asked the question really is on the right track, because we have to make this more than a women's issue. That's unfair, as he pointed out, because it has to do with, I mean, we're talking about not only humanity, but we're also talking about gross human rights violations. So it's not a women's issue. And so by contributing his voice to the discussion, as Ms. Martinez, as Attorney Martinez said, and also helping to raise awareness, I think that's a huge black hole for most Americans. Most people that I've talked to about mass incarceration of migrants think that the people are being detained because they've done something wrong. So then you hear that, you know, we'll come to legal. No, they are doing that. Most people have no idea about U.S. immigration law. So by contributing your voice and helping to educate people on the fact that these asylum seekers are complying with the U.S. law, they are doing things the right way. The gross human rights violations are something that they are being, you know, subjected to, and it is horrendous. And it's only going to continue because we will only see more caravans coming, because of, you know, the byproduct of U.S. imperialism.
Olga.
Well, I think that I agree with everything that was said. I think that the other thing is that as males, we need to be more informed about what it is that women go through, not just physiologically, but socially and economically. And if a brother shares that information with another brother, it does hold more water than when a woman speaks about it. Mm-hmm. So I think that in terms of being informed, like you heard about what's happening with the detention centers, what's happened with the reproductive abuses that have happened historically to women, then share that wealth, share that information, so that more conscious awareness is being built. Because a lot of people are misunderstanding what's going on, and they listen to mass media without knowing that there's little details in the story. And right, those details mean a lot. They mean, like, an understanding of the fact that, you know, Asian people aren't a target today because they did not create the COVID. They're not responsible for it. Immigrants are not causing the problems of poverty in America. And it's this idea that we are a problem, like women who got addicted, get their children torn away, but nobody realizes what led to the addiction. What happened to the story of these individuals that led to the addiction? As a drug counselor, I found out some horrible experiences that people went through. But if a brother is telling that story to another brother, he'll be more apt to listen than if I were to tell the stories.
Right.
Because we are kind of cliquish. You know, our society has taught us to click. Men with men, women with women, young with young, old with old. And, you know, we need to start breaking those barriers by sharing the wealth of the information. That's what I have.
And I pray we have a question from Zeke Kramer. How do other industrialized countries act compared to the United States? I think in reference to these issues. So whose turn is it? I think we start with Karina this time.
Well, in terms of from the perspective of seeking asylum, I couldn't speak on what other countries are doing, but it's obvious that the reason that many of the people, I mean, it's I think Juan Gonzalez from Democracy Now! Had it all in the title of his book called The Harvest of Empire. Why are they coming here? Because that's what we've done. We reap what you sow. We've devastated these economies. And that's why these people end up having to come here. I don't know what other countries are doing it as far as asylum goes, but I know a lot of people try to put the burden on Mexico, for example, and say, well, tell them to get asylum in Mexico. But at the same time, it's like, why is Mexico deserved to... Saul is being, you know, thrown the responsibility of solving these problems that came with U.S. empire. You know, why put that burden on a different country? So that's kind of illogical. But I don't know if this same thing is happening to people that are trying to apply for asylum in other countries as far as immigration goes.
Olgi?
I don't either. I'm just thinking about like my general scope, right? Whatever is happening in America may be happening elsewhere because America is supposed to have been the leader, the model. So I may not have specifics, but I know that sterilization is happening in other parts of the world. I know that it's not just happened in America or Puerto Rico. I also know that racism exists all over the world. So, growing consciousness, communicating better with each other so that we can get the information. I would welcome anyone to, you know, send information from other parts that are listening and let us know what's happening in their countries.
Annie, your thoughts?
I think that what we see, at least globally, with respect to like child welfare, other countries tend to be further ahead than the U.S. for a few different reasons. I think one is financially individual, like particularly in Europe, let's say. There are stipends for people who have children based on how many children they have. They have access to more affordable housing in certain countries in Europe. I mean, government housing is better than some of the regular housing here in the States. So when you've got people who have access to healthcare, have access to education, and have access to housing, all of a sudden you see it's a lot, let's not say easier, it's never easier to raise a kid, but it's a lot smoother and a lot more accessible to raise your child in a healthy way and not have to access the system or have them removed when all your basic needs are met because the government ensures that it does in some way, shape, or form. And so what you see is a lot of the failings of having a safety net as a nation that prioritizes unfettered capitalism and doesn't necessarily believe in providing a ground floor for everyone. And when you don't provide everyone a ground floor, those of us who are on the most of iffy grounds are the ones who are affected the hardest. And so we see that here, and we don't necessarily see that in other countries because they provide for a lot of the things that would put these children removed from the home.
Yeah, I'll actually add a little bit to that question. We have a global refugee crisis that's the biggest since World War II. And I think the biggest reason is US imperialism. We destabilized the whole Middle East and North Africa. And now there are millions and millions of people seeking refuge. And Europe is closing its borders. The same kind of right-wing, autocratic, racist, nationally chauvinistic regimes that Trump exemplified in this country, we're seeing in countries like Hungary and the right wing in Greece and in Italy and in France and in the United Kingdom. And so this is even going to get worse because we know there are going to be hundreds of millions of climate refugees. That's already in the pipeline. Bangladesh, the Mekong Delta, big bread baskets. People are, that land is going under the sea, no matter what we do at this point. So we need to learn how to handle this. And the one thing I'll say about Europe is, of all the political tendencies, from the far left to the far right, the Green Party has not had a nativistic faction. Even some of the left-wing parties got opportunistic when they saw the right gaining. And the Greens haven't done that. I have criticisms about most of the European Green parties on their economic and foreign policies, but I will say they have stood up for immigrants. So that's the bright light I see. But, you know, we can't do much about that. We can set a better example here, and hopefully that spreads. So anyway, that's what I can tell you, what I know. And I would just add, you know, look at Myanmar, Burma, and the Rohingya, and the other Muslim minorities that are fleeing that country because of Buddhist fundamentalism. And now the military taking over. Think of the people in Melanesia and Papua New Guinea and how they are stuck in detention camps trying to get to Australia, just like people from Central America here are. This is a huge global problem, and it's something that is something we got to address. Lucre Denouncer. Do you believe all contraceptives and other family planning services should be universally free for all people? And I think it's Olgi's turn to go first.
Yes, most definitely. I believe not only women's reproductive rights and tools, but I think all medicines should be free. All medical care.
Annie?
I agree 100%. I think I think universally we're starting to recognize that human rights should include what we say are supposed to be the American dream, which is like the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. You can't have life, liberty, or happiness if you can't have healthcare, you can't have housing, you can't have education. So healthcare needs to be completely free and accessible for all individuals. And part of healthcare is reproductive healthcare, which would include access to those types of contraceptives. And whether it be via surgery, I mean, even for men, if men want to have vasectomies, that should be something they should have easier access to. All of that goes under that concept of we should be providing that for individuals just as a society morally.
And Karina.
I would say definitely yes. I think there's absolutely no reason why a country like the U.S. can have a $760 billion defense budget and then say that Medicare for All is impossible. And I would ask people to consider what is the pathway to Medicare for All, and consider that Nancy Pelosi was talking about Medicare for All 27 years ago. Okay, so if we're looking for incremental progress through the Democratic Party, then you have to kind of refocus what your understanding is. When you're trying to figure out what the Democratic Party is going to do, there's only one question that matters. What do the donors want? And the donors are never going to want Medicare for all. So I would hope that we stop investing in dead ends and start investing in a real a way to smash the duopoly if we're ever going to get free medical care that I think is a human right.
And I'll just testify to that in New York, where the Democrats passed something called the New York Health Plan. Every session from the early 90s. And they said, well, we can't get it passed because the Senate is Republican. Well, they got the Democrats the majority in the Senate in the last session. And suddenly the Assembly Democrats couldn't pass it. And the Senate Democrats didn't pass it either. And you look at the donors, the health insurance industry, the hospital industry, big time donations to the Democratic Party. And we've had this situation where the Democrats said we can't get single payer because the Republicans control the governorship or one of the chambers. But there have been four cases where the Democrats got all three, governor, Senate, and assembly, Hawaii, California, Vermont, and now New York. So your last point about we need another party. In fact, my local sent a memorandum of support for the New York Health Act to all the state senators today. So we're still pushing, but we don't have the big bucks that they listen more to the donors than the voters. So, yeah. But we're trying. So, the power behind this curtain is not putting any more questions up. We usually go an hour. So I think we've used our time. And as always, we could go on, but we want to keep this, you know, in bite-sized pieces so people will actually watch the podcast. So first of all, thank you to Olga and Annie and Karina for coming on and educating us. And maybe you'd like to say a last word and tell people how they can be in touch with you. So I think it's Annie's turn.
Well, I want to thank everyone for participating and for listening and just adding to the conversation. It's important that we have these discussions and that we continue to grow our network of green socialists that are really trying to make a difference. I can be found online on Twitter. I can't remember my handle right now. I think it's Animal13. If you look for Annie Martinez, you'll be able to find me either there or on Facebook. Happy to keep this conversation going with others and continue to really smash the duopoly, as our lovely friend said.
And Karina, how can people get a hold of you?
Thanks. So, well, I'm on all social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can find me by looking up my proper name here that's listed in green. And I would also encourage people to check out Tele Jaguar. It's spelled T-E-L-E like Telesur, but Tele-Jaguar. So Tele Jaguar. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I would encourage people to do what Howie and Angela are doing, doing their own independent journalism here by raising awareness, creating our own platforms and sharing these kind of stories that are immediately relevant to our people. So you check out Tele Jaguar. Thanks.
And Olgi, how can people get a hold of you?
You can get me at ayakohoku@gmail.com. ayakohoku@gmail.com.
Maybe you should repeat that one more time so people get your pens ready and let us say it slow.
It's ayakohoku@gmail.com. ayakohoku@gmail.com.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for coming on and informing our people who are listening about these issues. I think, you know, my takeaway is we got to talk about reproductive justice is broader than just a narrow question of reproductive rights. I think one thing that comes out of this discussion is that this is an international problem. and imperialism. Karina mentioned Honduras, and we staged a coup down there. And it's a narco state. And they assassinated Berta Cáceres. Forgive my Spanish. But, you know, she was an indigenous environmental defender. That's what's going on there. That's why people are coming up here. And I mentioned the Middle East. I mean, so part of the problem is we've got to have an anti-imperialist movement that says we got to demilitarize our foreign policy. You know, let's make friends instead of enemies. Let's provide aid instead of arms. Let's have a global Green New Deal instead of a global military empire. And I think that's a movement that's been missing since, you know, the anti-Iraq war movement kind of collapsed after Kerry lost and then Obama won, and mostly it went home. And it's out of sight, out of mind for Americans, but it's very real all over the world. So I think that's another thing. And then I really appreciated everybody talking about how we need a party that represents, you know, working class people and everybody that loves peace, justice, the environment. And so in terms of getting a hold of our campaign, it's HowieHawkins.us. And we have a Green Socialist Organizing Project. That's greensocialist.net. So last thing I'll say that Angela and I always say is, this pandemic isn't over. We're about to have another surge with these mutant viruses. And I get my second shot tomorrow. I'm privileged being 68 years old, but a lot of you don't have it. So wear your mask, keep your social distancing, and when you can, get your vaccination. So good night, everybody, and thanks for joining us.